impacted Iraqi city of Fallujah said, Iraqis face long-term diffuse exposure at all stages of the life course, so the health effects were varied and widespread. Living near U.S. bases in Iraq and therefore near burn pits increased the likelihood of giving birth to a child with a birth defect or of getting cancer. Burn pits are not the biggest figure of environmental and health harm for Iraqis, Professor Rubai elaborated, adding, they have also been facing military occupation, bombings, shootings, displacements, and layers of military incursion by different occupation forces since the U.S. invasion. These things have all added to collapse in public infrastructure that would be used to contend with the health effects of burn pits, poor overall health, and damaged conditions for farming and fishing. She concluded, there is one really great way to avoid war-related injury, which is to not go to war. The scars of the U.S. invasions and occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan are deep, spanning decades. We will never know how many millions were killed or injured. The United States bear responsibility and owes the survivors reparations, no less than has been pledged belatedly to U.S. veterans.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the emergence of a new quadrilateral grouping, including India, Israel, UAE, and the US, and how New Delhi has very little to gain from it. And we shall also take a look at the annual Muharram commemorations in Hindu-majority India, the traditions, the history, and why Muslims are treading cautiously now.
A new quadrilateral group, abbreviated as I2U2, has recently announced its arrival on the global stage, bringing together India, Israel, the United Arab Emirates, and the United States. The inaugural meeting of the group, which was conceptualized in October last year, took place virtually last month during US President Joe Biden's West Asia tour. Dubbed the West Asia Quad, I2U2 is seen as a fresh attempt by the US to rally friends and allies to contain China's growing influence.
The emergence of the I2U2 group amid rapidly changing geopolitical dynamics has created a buzz in the region's intelligentsia circles. The group's stated objectives point to six mutually identified areas, including water, energy, transportation, space, health, and food security. But there's more to it than meets the eye. According to India's foreign ministry, the quadrilateral group was conceptualized on October 18 last year during the meeting of the foreign ministries of the four countries, India, Israel, the United Arab Emirates, and the United States. Ahead of the group's first virtual summit last month, a former Israeli national security advisor described the formation of I2U2 as a significant development and India's participation in it as a game changer. Regional observers believe the group seeks to integrate the West Asian region with Indo-Pacific, built on the so-called Abraham Accords that saw many Arab regimes normalizing their ties with the Israeli regime and resist growing Chinese influence in the region. While India's traditional rivalry with China and growing proximity to the Israeli regime appears to be pushing it closer to the U.S., there is a growing debate on whether these alliances with short-term gains could eventually prove detrimental to India's national interests and global ambitions in the long run.
India, which has already drawn flak for joining the informal strategic forum of Quad with the US, Australia and Japan, again finds itself in a precarious situation after joining hands with Israel, the United Arab Emirates and the United States as part of the I2U2 group. The Hindu nationalist government in New Delhi, experts believe, is being used as a pawn in a sinister game played by the US and Israel to refill the fizz that has gone out of the so-called Abraham Accords.
Political developments in the DRC in the last 3 months.
Chargé d'affaires in India's permanent mission to the UN, Ambassador R. Ravindra, told the World Body on July 27 that New Delhi has vital stakes in peace and prosperity in the Middle East, and through the I2U2 grouping, it will make significant contributions to energy, food security, and economic growth in the region. The message was not lost on regional observers, who see India serving the interests of the U.S. and Israel through this quadrilateral alliance for short-term gains at the cost of long-term goals. With President Joe Biden's popularity ratings plummeting amid rising inflation in the U.S., Russia and China declaring the end of the old world order, and the so-called Abraham Accords withering away without any tangible results, experts believe India risks squandering its soft power through its participation in the I2U2 group. India has so far resisted calls from the West to snap ties with Moscow over the Ukraine war. But as Biden's national security advisor Jake Sullivan said recently, Washington will continue to make efforts to derail India's time-tested relationship with Russia. As someone said recently, there are moments when one has to learn to say no, to avoid making a grave folly, and to reject becoming a surrogate of extra-regional powers. The ball here is in India's court.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Mr. Zafar Khan, a retired academic and commentator from Luton. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Zafar Khan. Now, a new quadrilateral group, the I2U2, held its first summit during U.S. President Joe Biden's West Asia tour. Now, do you think the actual purpose of this formation goes beyond the stated objectives?
I think a short answer to that would be that there is a bit of both in it. I mean, the stated objectives as well as the unstated objectives. Obviously the stated, I think it goes beyond the economic and other cooperation. There is also a strategic aspect of it, in light of the regional objectives of the United States and indeed of Israel and also India. We mustn't forget India and indeed the UAE and other states as well.
Now, Mr. Khan, a former Israeli regime official termed India's participation in the grouping as a game changer. Now, how would you interpret this?
I mean, my feeling is, coming from a Kashmiri background and having an active role in the Kashmiri political resistance for the right to self-determination, is that India is also looking for ingress into the Muslim world, particularly in the Middle East, and also wants a role to play at the world stage, and who better than the Americans being partners in this. And of course, Israel also has interests, and therefore, I think it is important for both India and Israel and others in this this, if you like, association, this organization, Quad, call it Quad, for their particular interests. And India certainly has an interest. India wants to actually muscle into the Muslim world, particularly the Arab world, and to attract investment into India itself. And so on and so forth. And I think for Israel, it is more to pacify the region, to ensure that its ascendancy, both political and strategic, is maintained. So and for United States, it has a wider objective of stopping the Chinese sort of a march towards West Asia and indeed into Africa and so on, and Europe as well, through Pakistan, of course.
Mr. Zafar Khan, many believe the US and Israel lured India into this alliance for their own interests, as it does not translate into long-term gains for New Delhi. What's your take on this?
I think the Indians have they have a fear of the Chinese, because the Chinese have their presence in a very big way right across borders that India and China have. So that is a factor that India wants to align with the United States and indeed the Quad, the Quad, that is the United States, India, Japan, and Australia. And this Quad, which is perhaps a relatively smaller Quad, but more politically and strategically just as important for all the partners in it. And to that extent, I think India also wants to consolidate the oppressive change that it has instituted in Kashmir itself since 2019. And so I think India may have been lured by Israel and America for their own interest, but India is also here very much playing into its own interest. And of course, it wants to influence the Muslim world. It wants to it wants to also ensure that its presence is much more acceptable within the OIC, and particularly the kind of oil rich who have the capacity, including of course Saudi Arabia, have a huge capacity to invest, which they are already doing in India itself.
I would like to thank Mr. Zafar Khan for being on the program. He's a retired academic and commentator from Luton. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Senior Indian journalist Smita Sharma cites U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan as saying that U.S. can play a central role in helping deepen Israel's integration into the region. And India also has a role to play in that, pointing to the unholy nexus. Sidna Sibal, a New Delhi-based journalist, remarks that the key announcement at the first I2U2 summit was setting up a UAE-funded $2 billion agricultural parks project in India, with technical expertise from Israel and support from the U.S. private sector. Analyst and writer Samuel Ramani, referring to the emergence of the I2U2 format, says it strengthens the so-called Abraham Accords and U.S.-India cooperation in the Middle East amid China's growing regional influence.
It's that time of the year again when Muslims across the world renew their allegiance to the glorious principles exemplified by the martyrs of Karbala more than 14 centuries ago. Like in other countries, Muharram is commemorated with tremendous religious fervor in India, home to 200 million Muslims. The annual Muharram commemorations in this South Asian country date back many centuries, with iconic cities such as Lucknow, Hyderabad, Kolkata, New Delhi and Mumbai considered traditional hubs of Azadari.
Although Shia missionaries started coming to the Indian subcontinent many centuries ago, bringing with them the enlightening message of Islam, it was only in the 16th and 17th centuries that the founding dynasty of Hyderabad, the Qutb Shahis, popularized the annual Muharram commemorations by building Ashura Khanas across the erstwhile state of Telangana.
Imam Hussein at the ground of Karbala quoted very ecstatic words. That was like, a glorious death is better than a shameful life. Give your life in the way of truth, in the way of humanity, in the way of peace, in the way of living.
Today, there are about 140 such Ashura Khanas in the city of Hyderabad that come alive every Muharram. In the 18th century, the ruling Nawab dynasty of Awadh in present-day Lucknow infused a new life to the tradition of Muharram mourning. It was this time the first Muharram procession was taken out in India in Awadh under the patronage of the ruler of the time. Today, Muharram commemorations have spread far and wide across India, with massive Ashura processions seen in major cities such as New Delhi and Mumbai. The day of Ashura is a gazetted holiday in the Hindu-majority country. Another interesting highlight of Muharram commemorations in India is how a section of Hindus, known as Hussaini Brahmins, take an active part in it. They believe their ancestor, along with his sons, fought alongside Imam Hussein in the desert plains of Karbala 14 centuries ago.
Karbala is not only related to Shia Muslims or other sects of Muslims. It is a place where peace took birth 1400 years ago, and still the world is propagating peace of Imam Hussein.
Except for some sporadic incidents, the annual Muharram commemorations in different parts of India have largely been incident-free over the years. In most cases, the majority Hindus have actively cooperated with minority Muslims in taking out street processions in small and big cities. This year, however, Muharram comes amid a rising tide of hate and intolerance and growing religious polarization in the Bharatiya Janata Party-ruled India, stoking fears that the yearly processions could face attacks from Hindu radical groups, especially in states ruled by the Hindu Nationalist Party.
Last week, the Muslim community in Kanpur city of India's biggest province, Uttar Pradesh, announced that they will not be taking out a traditional Pakhi procession this Muharram. The organizers said the decision was taken to avert the possibility of any untoward incident that may lead to a law and order situation in the month of Muharram. In early June, the city had witnessed violent communal clashes amid protests over the blasphemous remarks made against Prophet Muhammad by senior BJP leaders.
Imam Hussein's sacrifice teaches us patience and being steadfast to our mission. We see Muslims across the globe are suffering, from Palestine to Syria, from Rohingya to Kashmir. Muslims are fighting against oppression. All our will comes from the pages of the Battle of Karbala.
Muslims in Uttar Pradesh, which is ruled by the BJP, are treading cautiously. They don't want Muharram commemorations, which represent a rallying cry for truth and justice, to become a source of hate and hostilities. But it's not just about them. Muslims in other major Indian cities, including New Delhi, Mumbai, Bangalore, and Allahabad, are also planning low-key Ashura events this year.
The world's biggest democracy is depriving us of all our freedoms and claims Kashmir to be its integral part. This is interference in our religious rituals.
Over the past 7 years, under the Hindu nationalist BJP government, Muslims in India have been marginalized, discriminated against, attacked, lynched, and denied their fundamental right to religious freedom. Women have faced the hijab ban, while men have been barred from offering prayers in open spaces, creating a hostile environment for more than 200 million population, one of the world's largest Muslim communities.
Now to talk more on this, we are joined by Professor Ali Nadeem Rezavi, Professor of History at Aligarh Muslim University, joining us from Haswa, Fatehpur district in Uttar Pradesh, which is known for its Azadari. First of all, welcome to the program, Professor. Now, Muharram has always been observed with tremendous fervor in India. Can you tell us the role of places like Lucknow and Hyderabad, both of whom had Shia ruling dynasties in promoting the tradition of Azadari in India?
In India, as you rightly pointed out, that there are two centers of Azadari, one in the Deccan, around Hyderabad, and the second in Awadh, that is Lucknow. But if you actually look at the history of Azadari, it goes back in time. In fact, it is from the 14th century that one starts getting information regarding the Ashra-e-Muharram, during which we are informed that at least in the area of Delhi and in areas around Delhi, Tuskies, Tuskiras, or Majalis, as it was then known, were being held. And by 18th century, we come to know from a number of Persian sources of the period that on each and every marketplace around Delhi, during the 10 days of Muharram, members would be set, pulpits would be set, and there would be orators who would be talking about the sacrifice of Imam Hussein on the 10th of Muharram.
Professor, can you tell us how are the annual Muharram commemorations in India different and unique from other parts of the world in terms of customs and traditions?
When Muharram is commemorated in India, if you compare it with the commemorations being held, say, in Iraq or Iran, or at other places, in Central Asia, for example, we know that even under Timur, Muharram was being celebrated in the Central Asian Timurid lands. We find that there are a large number of common elements, similarities. But then along with those similar traditions, there are a number of things which differ from other places. For example, the very concept of Imam Bala is peculiar to the Indian subcontinent. Bala means an enclosure, and there were certain structures which were built here known as Imam Bala, the enclosures of the Imam, which were very different from what was happening in Iran, say for example under the Safavids, where the Taziyah was a passion play, a drama. In the Indian subcontinent, Taziyah means a paper or a wood or some other material through which replicas of the tomb of Imam Hussein are made. They are known as Taziyahs. Whereas in the other countries, such type of Taziyahs were not known. They were typical to the Indian context.
Professor, we hear a lot about Husseini Brahmins and how they join Muslims in observing Muharram every year. Can you tell us more about them?
As far as the tradition of, the legends about Husseini Brahmins is concerned, this is a tradition which is prevalent not only amongst the Shias of India, who believe that there was a section of the Brahmins who rushed to help Imam Hussein after the battle of Karbala took place. But this is a tradition which is quite alive. In fact, in a section of Hindu Brahmins who today go by the name, caste name Dutt, there are a large number of, Indian Mumbai film stars, Sanjay Dutt and Nargis Dutt and so on and so forth, a large number of them. All these people, basically from the region of Punjab in North India, who are Brahmins, who write against their name Dutt, they themselves believe that their ancestors, on hearing the call that Imam Hussein had issued from the battle ground of Karbala, that when he gave the call, clarion call, that whosoever can come and help me in this cause, So in response to that cause, you know, a group of Brahmins left for Iraq. They reached after Karbala had happened. The Haram had been caught. They were prisoners and they were being taken to the court of Yazid. Midway, these Brahmins from Hindustan, had a fight with the Umayyad army, in which a large number of Brahmins gave their life. So among the Brahmins, it is said that they still claim that their necks have, a line which symbolizes that they had cut off their necks and heads for the cause of Imam Hussein.
On that note, I would like to thank Professor of History Ali Nadim Rezavi for being on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Uzair Rizvi, a New Delhi-based journalist and fact-checker, shares what he calls great photographs from North India's Lucknow city, known as the epicenter for Azadari in the Urdu-speaking world, before the tradition spread to other parts of the region. This Twitter user shares a picture of one Hindu man named Rajesh, who comes and sits outside a Husseiniya in southern Indian city of Hyderabad every Muharram to take care of slippers and shoes of mourners. Journalist Raj Gopal says a traditional Muharram procession in northern Indian city of Kanpur has been cancelled this year, with a cleric asking people to perform azadari at home amid fear of violent attacks by radical Hindus.
And that was our episode about the emergence of a new quadrilateral group, including India, and the Muharram commemoration in the country. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Closer, Iran.
Hi, Mum. Don't worry, I'm okay. I'm just near the city of Abadan. Okay, I'll call you as soon as I arrive. Bye-bye. Traveled from Tehran to the southern province of Khuzestan to the city of Abadan. You know, today is Ashura, the 10th of the morning month of Muharram, which marks the tragic martyrdom of Imam Hussein and his companions. I'm going to have a tour around Abadan in order to see the special rituals of Ashura in this city, which I have heard is very impressive. Stay with me. Millions of Muslims in Iran and other countries commemorate the 10th day of Muharram, which marks the tragic martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, and his loyal companions. For Muslims, Ashura marks the climax of the remembrance of Muharram and commemorates the martyrdom of Hussein ibn Ali, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, at the Battle of Karbala on Muharram 10th in the year 61 AH, corresponding to 680 CE. In Ashura, Iranian Muslims, along with others from around the world, in a sign of unity, come to the streets and mark the day and send a message to the world that they will not surrender to the oppression of any power, no matter how big it is. These rituals are very impressive in the southern province of Khuzestan. The people of this province usually hold mourning ceremonies of the month of Muharram at homes, mosques, Husseinias, and tekiyas. From the cities of Dizful, Shushtar, Behbahan, and Ram Hormuz to Ahvaz and Abadan in this province, the lovers of Imam Hussein show their love and devotion to him in the form of various programs. Arrived at Abadan. The ceremonies of Ashura have begun early in the morning. The entire city is full of big pieces of black cloth, and there are mukebs in every corner of the streets. Mukebs are tents erected along the way during the month of Muharram and Safar. These mukebs serve the mourners with cool water, tea, or food. A little boy wearing a black shirt and a green headband with the writing of Ya Hussein is coming toward me. Thank you. He brought me a glass of cool water. Salutations to Hussein, who was martyred while thirsty. Oh, over there is a huge crowd of people. Young and old are beating on their chests. In Khuzestan, there is an age-old tradition of a certain style of chest beating known as uniform chest beating or one chest beating. Uniform chest beating usually follows mourning ceremonies using cymbals and drums. In some streets, Ta'ziyeh is performed, reenacting the Battle of Karbala and the hardships suffered by Imam Hussein and his companions at the hands of the enemy forces. Oh, a big crowd of mourners have gathered here in order to watch Ta'ziyeh. Let me get closer. Oh, it's very dramatic. A few meters away, Maqtalkhani ritual is being performed. In Maqtalkhani, the details of the tragic event of Ashura is described completely. Oh, everyone is shedding tears as the scenes of Ashura come in front of everyone's eyes. I was wondering that the love for Hussein never dies. It's like an inextinguishable fire in the heart of all freedom-seeking people of the world. Now it's time for the noon prayers of Ashura.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
A series of drills across six zones surrounding Chinese Taipei. Conventional missile firepower assault in the waters east of Taiwan. More than 100 warplanes, including fighters and bombers, as well as over 10 destroyers and frigates. These are the largest military drills that China has conducted perhaps ever, showing its awesome military might. This level of force displayed in such a manner shows how angry China is at the U.S. and the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit.
Interparliamentary. Since 1949, that Taiwan is an integral part of China. And they see that as China has moved from being under the control of imperialist powers to becoming a strong, independent nation, that they intend to exercise sovereignty over all of their historical, geographical range, including Taiwan.
Ironically, the G7 group of countries and the High Representative of the European Union have now issued a statement condemning these exercises, claiming that they threaten the stability of the region. In this instance, the European side has now backed the U.S. when it comes to its stance against China.
Is this another Ukraine conflict scenario playing out? China sees this as a provocation, since it is endorsing and encouraging pro-separatists and pro-independence forces on the island.
Chinese made their strikes, probably using our visit as an excuse. Let me close by saying this. The Chinese have tried to isolate Taiwan. They may try to keep Taiwan from visiting or participating in other places, but they will not isolate Taiwan by preventing us to travel there.
China has in the past viewed Chinese Taipei as part of its territory. It has also publicly stated that it may take it by force one day if necessary. This is where the U.S. and now Europe come in. Just like Ukraine, both are warning China against any thoughts of a takeover, which parallels the conflict in Ukraine.
The People's Liberation Army has now declared 7 restricted zones near Taiwan and say that they will extend a range of military exercises through Monday. These provocative actions are a significant escalation.
I think the issue of provoking China is this. The United States does not have, as part of its sort of thinking, that somebody is going to be our equal. We have in the Western Pacific this amazing amount of military. Well, China happens to be there. You know, that's part of the world that they're in. And I think that as time goes on, and they have been very clear about this, that they're not prepared to cede American military hegemony to us in the Western Pacific much longer.
But China is not Ukraine if the military display of China is anything to go by. The U.S. provocations against China and Europe's support come at a dangerous time when the world economy is on the precipice. The U.S. anti-China stance and China's maneuvers are taking place along some of the world's busiest shipping routes. Let's not forget, the global supply of vital semiconductors and electronic equipment produced in East Asia are in this region. Additionally, more than 60% of global maritime trade and more than 22% of the total global trade passes through the South China Sea. Is the U.S. and its European allies willing to risk this?
The war in Ukraine has created massive political and geostrategic shifts in alliances at regional and international levels. The war has now brought back the specter of the Cold War to the global scene. Russia, which is at loggerheads with the United States and its Western allies, says the era of constructive cooperation between Russia and Western countries is irrevocably over. Moscow says the end of the partnership is regardless of the result of the war in Ukraine. Regardless of the duration and outcome of Russia's special military operation in Ukraine, we can already state now that the 30-year era of generally constructive, though not problematic, cooperation with the West is irrevocably over.
Well, in politics, nothing is definite and irreversible, as we well know. Certainly, the situation is deeply affected by the events and the stanch positions of either side, particularly the Western and the Russian side. So in the near future, which means in the forthcoming months, is not envisageable a reversal of the distancing that has been signaled by both Russia and the United States and Europe on the issue of Ukraine.
The Russian official added that the current crisis has provided a unique opportunity to get rid of, quote, residual illusions. He also added that Moscow will use the crisis to go beyond the paradigm of what he described as friendly absorption, which Moscow says has been produced over and over again since 1992. It refers to a climate in which dominant powers following the collapse of the Soviet Union promised Russia to accept it as a member of advanced Western developed nations. It's now a fact that the West and its allies are no longer the hegemon powers at the international stage. Following the war in Ukraine, the West imposed a raft of massive and unprecedented sanctions on Russia in a bid to weaken Moscow or to potentially make its economy collapse. The sanctions have hurt Russia's economy, but did not trigger its collapse. On the contrary, Russia's oil and gas revenues have soared over the past few months.
The Western side, with its approach, is also imposing a set of rules which are based on its own interests, although they pretend these rules should be universal. The rest of the world is instead proposing to identify shared rules which may differ in the practice according to the latitude and the cultural experience of the different societies. So this is the existential clash between the two sides.
It's now Western citizens who are paying higher gas and energy prices. The crisis has indeed negatively affected European and North American nations and their economies. It's now widely believed that the US has failed to create a united global front against Russia. The asymmetry of interests and perspectives between Washington and Moscow is unlikely to change anytime soon.
On this, we have to add the fact that the manufacturing capacity of the world has moved from the West to the East, particularly to the Far East, which is Asia. And this weakens considerably the perspectives of the West in long-term confrontation with the rest of the world.
And the latest spat between the United States and China over Taiwan is likely to further strain the relations between the Western-led bloc and the emerging counter-hegemonic alliance. Under these circumstances, emerging powers like Iran, with its vast energy sources and rising military might, can play a pivotal role in the shifting balances between the East and the West.
Tensions are ratcheting up between the United States and China over U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan. Pelosi arrived in Taiwan late on Tuesday, despite harsh warnings from China. Pelosi is known for her anti-China stance and is the highest elected U.S. official to visit the island since 1997. China is now furious over the visit and has warned of a harsh response.
Well, first of all, both countries, the United States and China, cannot afford to have a hot war now because November is coming up. In the United States, it's the midterm elections. Both Nancy Pelosi and Biden risk seeing their support slipping away. As for China, November is also coming up, signaling the National People's Congress, which is supposed to confirm the presidency's third term, as well as unveiling a new leadership lineup of the top six or seven leaders of the Standing Committee of the Politburo.
China has now threatened to carry out, quote, targeted military operations in response to the visit. The situation around Chinese Taipei is already tense. China has deployed military hardware there and is conducting massive, large-scale drills. The exercises feature J-20 stealth fighter jets and test firing of conventional missiles. Chinese military officials say the military exercises are a, quote, a stern deterrence against the United States over Taiwan and a serious warning for supporters of Taiwan independence. This is while some believe the goal of these exercises is to prepare for the military fight with Taiwan. But some believe the visit has in fact put China in the difficult position of having to show a resolute response while avoiding a full-blown conflict.
China's military exercises have been planned in advance. So there is a live fire military exercises now going on quite near Taiwan, less than 100 miles. And then six zones, military exercise zones, have been identified surrounding the Taiwan island with live fire military exercises in all the six regions, in effect blockading the Taiwan island for 3 days. just to show, just to teach Taiwan a lesson and to send a clear signal that China's red line has truly been crossed.
Pelosi's visit to Taiwan has been condemned by China's allies, including Iran and Russia. Moscow says Russia backs China over the Taiwan issue, warning that the provocative trip would put the United States on a collision course with Beijing. Iran says the visit to Taiwan is a turning point in the already tense ties between China and the US and will have reverberations across the world. Iran has also expressed full support for the One China policy. The crisis dates back to the time when the People's Republic of China was created in 1949. After the Communist Party seized power in mainland China in 1949, the US refused to recognize it as a rightful government in China. Back then, the US decided to open its embassy in Taipei. In the 1970s, Washington and Beijing decided to normalize their ties. In 1979, the US formally recognized the communist-run People's Republic of China and cut ties with Taipei. This meant that the United States recognized the People's Republic of China as the only legal government of China. But following that, the US Congress passed the Taiwan Relations Act, which has underpinned the US policy towards Taiwan ever since. The act authorizes de facto diplomatic relations and allows the US government to provide weapons to Taiwan.
The unification of Taiwan is very high up on Beijing's agenda. In fact, President Xi Jinping has made it quite plain that the latest time frame for Taiwan unification is the 2049, which is the 100th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China. But the ideal solution is still peaceful unification. But peaceful unification comes up with the reality that most of the Taiwanese people do not want a unification, but neither do they want independence, because independence would affect their livelihood or threaten their security. All they want is to maintain the status quo forever. But again, this risks that Taiwan will be drifting further and further away from China. So I think that China is likely to adopt a policy in the same way as they China succeeded now in having Hong Kong being united with the motherland.
The U.S. is now the largest arms provider to Taiwan. The Taiwan crisis comes amid shifting geopolitical alliance. The Ukraine crisis has already weakened the hegemonic position of the United States and its allies. It now appears that Washington is trying to provoke another crisis in the East Asia region to reassert its hegemony. The United States says it has killed the al-Qaeda leader in Kabul, Afghanistan. Ayman al-Zawahiri has apparently been killed by a CIA drone strike over the weekend.
After carefully considering the clear and convincing evidence of his location, I authorized a precision strike that would remove him from the battlefield once and for all.
Biden claimed that no civilians were killed in the strike, but the U.S. is known for undercounting civilian casualties. Back in August 2021, the U.S. killed 10 civilians, including 7 children. Initially, the U.S. military claimed the strike killed ISIS-K members.
It was announced by the United States military that a drone strike in Kabul had killed a ISIL operative who was getting ready, that they had caught him on the verge of another suicide attack at the airport. And then the United States was congratulating itself for saving lives. The story fell apart very quickly in the next few days. And even though the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Miley, called it a righteous strike, it turned out that this was a man named Samari Amari, who was a employee of a California-based NGO, humanitarian organization called Nutrition and Education.
Afghanistan's ruling Taliban group have confirmed the strike and described it as a violation of the country's sovereignty, but they have not commented on Az-Zawahiri's death. Az-Zawahiri was 71 years old when he was killed in the drone strike. His death is seen as the biggest blow to Al-Qaeda since his former leader Osama bin Laden was killed by US troops in Pakistan in 2011. He had apparently taken over the leadership of the group after bin Laden's death. Az-Zawahiri grew up in Egypt and was a surgeon. He later joined bin Laden and is said to have masterminded the 9/11 attacks in the United States. Since 9/11 in 2001, he had been on the run and had a $25 million bounty on his head. Al-Qaeda has yet to issue a statement on his killing. Back in 2020, the United States signed an agreement with the Taliban in the Qatari capital, Doha. The agreement paved the way for the disastrous departure of US troops from Afghanistan. Based on the agreement, the Taliban had promised not to allow the presence of terrorist elements on Afghanistan's territory. Now, the United States accused the group of violating that deal. The US invaded Afghanistan in 2001 following the 9/11 attacks. The aim of the mission was to root out Al-Qaeda militants. The mission, which has lasted nearly 20 years, cost the lives of hundreds of thousands of Afghan civilians. The US-Taliban deal showed that Washington failed to reach its objectives. But Afghanistan was the victim of hawkish US politicians even before the 9/11 attacks.
Yes, well, the United States has been supporting terrorism. Al-Qaeda itself is an offshoot of outgrowth, as the Taliban, of U.S. support for insurgents who were resisting the Soviet invasion in 1979. This is our creation. Even Osama bin Laden himself was on the CIA payroll and was being praised by American presidents as a freedom fighter. So we have this history.
It's now a well-established fact that the United States helped create the Al-Qaeda in the 1980s against the Soviets who had invaded Afghanistan. The operation to create Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan was masterminded by the United States and financed by the Saudis. And the logistical work was carried out by Pakistan.
We also have a history of kind of moving in and out of Pakistan. I mean, let's remember here, the people we are fighting today, we funded 20 years ago. And we did it because we were locked in this struggle with the Soviet Union. They invaded Afghanistan, and we did not want to see them control Central Asia. And we went to work. And it was President Reagan, in partnership with the Congress, led by Democrats, who said, you know what, sounds like a pretty good idea. Let's deal with the ISI and the Pakistani military, and let's go recruit these Mujahideen. And let's get some to come from Saudi Arabia and other places, importing their Wahhabi brand of Islam, so that we can go beat the Soviet Union.
Leaked emails also show that Hillary Clinton, the then U.S. presidential candidate, was furious over the money channeled by Saudi Arabia and other Persian Gulf Arab countries to terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda and the ISIL.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.